It's your boy, just one of the guys down here. Well, I could be more specific. I'm a human. And I just wanted to, you know, for the sake of all of us earthlings out there, just wanted to say,
welcome to Conserving Earth. Our series focuses on natural resources and what scientists, agencies, conservationists, and interested citizens are doing to conserve wildlife and wild places, provide ecological services for humans, and of course, protect our beautiful outdoors for future generations. Several Texas and Louisiana conservationists will be hosting this series. Today, I'm your host. I'm Janice Bizanson, the Senior Policy Director for Texas Conservation Alliance. We are delighted to have here a special guest who will give us a new angle on what constitutes wildlife habitat and tell us about an exciting initiative that's making headlines all over the country. I want a warm welcome to Ben Jones, Executive Director of Texas Conservation Alliance and a co-leader in promoting Lights Out for Wildlife. Ben, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Janice. It's great to be with you here in the studio and to talk about such an exciting topic.
Well, we're excited. Tell us a little bit about your background and why you've made a career in conservation.
You bet. Well, I went to college and thought I'd be a veterinarian, like a lot of people who want to work with wildlife, and so started down that track and realized pretty quickly that wasn't the career path for me. But I began, you know, thinking, what could I do as a profession working with animals? So like a lot of students who aren't exactly sure what they want to do next, I went to grad school and postponed reality for two more years, and I studied biology at the molecular level. So I was interested in that and thought, well, maybe I'd like to teach or be a professor at some point. But graduated from graduate school and then went into, of all things, big business for a couple of years, and then realized, did some soul searching and realized that I really wanted to be with wildlife, my original passion, and work with animals and do what I could to help protect them. So I started my career after that stint in business and joined the Dallas Zoo, was there for a number of years, and then to the National Audubon Society, was also there for a number of years, and now I'm here with Texas Conservation Alliance, the state program for Texas of the National Wildlife Federation, and I'm really thrilled to be here.
Well, we're really thrilled to have you. There's actually been quite a bit of news coverage for this program called Lights Out for Wildlife. Would you tell us what it is and why is it so important?
You bet. Well, we hear a lot about the environment and about threats to wildlife and about threats to the broader environment and sources of pollution. But a lot of times we don't think about the photon or the light beam as a source, a potential source of pollution, when in fact studies are beginning to show more and more that artificial lighting can be a pollutant to the environment, and it has pretty injurious effects on a number of taxa within the wildlife world. And particularly for this campaign, Lights Out for Wildlife, we're focused on bird life. And so we're trying to make known on a broad scale how injurious artificial light can be to birds, especially migratory birds, and what people can do to mitigate that threat and take action to help save all those migratory birds.
Well, tell us the effects. Tell us, what does it do? Why is this a problem for birds, migratory birds?
You bet. So for migratory birds, it might sound odd, but light, artificial light, first of all, think of light and natural sources of light. And you think about natural terrestrial sources of light. What light is emanated from the ground naturally? And there's only very few sources that happen in the natural world. You could think about maybe volcanoes and lava that's glowing, maybe some phosphorescent bays and things like that you might have heard about, or small organisms fluoresce whenever you move through the water. But it's just so few and far between. But now imagine artificial sources of light, everything from street lights to billboards to commercial lights to buildings to home lighting. on and on, landscape lighting, on and on and on. And you can imagine how radically transformed the terrestrial environment has been over, well, over decades now, over a century plus. So what's happening is the science is showing us more and more and more, but birds are attracted to light. Lots of creatures are attracted to light, even invertebrates that you might see flying around a street light or a porch light. Light is very attractive. And so what happens in the case of bird life is that light attracts birds down from their very high migratory elevations, many, well, thousands of plus feet up into the air. They come down attracted to light, and it's also very disorienting and confusing to birds. So this light attracts them down out of their high elevations down into cities where there are a number of dangers or potential dangers that, you know, that could lead to a bad outcome or for the bird life. So what we're trying to do is bring awareness to it. Like I say, not a lot of people are aware that light's very attractive to birds and what happens to migratory birds whenever they're impacted by light pollution.
You spoke of migratory birds. I mean, most of us are used to thinking about the birds that we see in the backyard, or we go to the river or the lake and we see water birds or seabirds. Tell us about the migratory bird patterns and what birds migrate.
You bet. Well, this is one of my favorite things in ornithology, and it's just migration is really a mystery. We know a lot about it, but how birds navigate on these thousands of miles of journeys what they've never even been on their first migration, if you think about it, is just still a mystery to science. And that's one of the best things about science to me, is all these unanswered questions that remain. So when we talk about migration and bird life, and we talk about the Western Hemisphere, North America, down into Latin America and South America, migration really happens twice a year for birds. That's a simplistic way of putting it, because various types of migration happen throughout the year, even some east-west migrations. But for the most part, we're going to talk in this sort of simple terms, it's north and south to north migrations across the hemisphere, and it varies by species. Every fall and every spring. Now you might say, why do birds migrate? And a lot of times people think of, say in the north, whenever it gets really, really cold, they think birds can't handle that cold and they don't have the insulation, but that's not true. They are, they're well equipped to handle cold weather, but what they're avoiding, or I should say following, by leaving the north and moving towards the south, down into the southern part of the U.S. and then further down into Latin America and even further down into South America, some species, is they're following food. Migration is really the following of food sources. That's what it's about, not avoiding cold. Although when you think about waterfowl and they pour in through the south, hunters know this, through the fall, you know, they're avoiding frozen over ponds and lakes and creeks, and that's where their food sources are. These waterfowl are eating food out of water, out of ponds and lakes and things. And so when the top's frozen, they don't have access to food. And that's why this huge waterfowl migration happens every fall. Other birds do it too. The insectivores, those that are eating insects, you can imagine up in the cold and the snow, there are not a lot of insect life out there. So they're following food. They're coming down to the south to still have insects to eat. So that's the gist of it. Migration is the following of food. And there's this giant north-south migration that happens every fall. Roughly put, I'd say September, October are the hearts of migration in our region. The fall migration. And then in the spring, it's kind of a turnaround. All those scores of birds that have left North America and are down in South America, those in Latin America as well, are turning back and heading north. They're leaving their basically winter home and headed back up into our area where they raise their young and where spring has sprung and insect life abounds and plant life and all the things that birds eat are prevalent for raising young. So that's really the gist of it.
Well, you mentioned waterfowl, like ducks and geese. What are some other birds that tend to migrate?
Right. So yes, that. Yes. Oh, some waterfowl. Not all waterfowl. There are some residential populations of certain waterfowl species, but lots of waterfowl migrate. So other types of birds that migrate would be the buntings. Maybe folks have seen the indigo bunting, this beautiful, beautiful, brilliant blue. That's a migratory species. It's here through the summer months and then heads back down to the Yucatan and even southern Chiapas part of Mexico down into Guatemala and even further south. Also, its cousin, the painted bunting, which is rainbow-colored bird, one of the most beautiful and dramatic birds in our area that raises its young here. Also migratory. People say that looks like a bird that should be in a southern rainforest, or that looks like a rainforest bird you might see in a book. And that's the interesting thing, is that they, in fact, for part of their lives every winter here, they are rainforest birds, or they're, you know, forest birds, tropical forest birds, I should say. And that, you know, they do spend half their life in the tropical forest. So those are two examples there, but there are many others. All of our swallows, for the most part, are migratory. So the barn swallows, the purple martins, the cliff swallows, the northern rough-wing swallows, all of those guys will be gathering up at the end of summer, and in huge flocks will gather and stage and stage and stage in these massive flocks. Sometimes you hear about it in your area. And then they'll all head south together. And just what triggers it, we don't know. Still mysterious, but they do it. And then a couple of other examples of birds that migrate are most of the warblers. So some warblers stay, a couple of species do, but the far majority of warblers are migratory. The scissor-tailed flycatcher that we love seeing, with those really long tail feathers, maybe on a barbed wire fence or fence post, also migratory. So these birds disappear. Now, lots of these species do every year. And if you're paying attention, you notice it. And if you're paying attention, you also sort of notice when you start to see them come back. And people can mark their calendars by some of the species. It's that reliable a date. It's pretty amazing.
We're talking about fairly small birds, right? I mean, how long are these birds? I mean, a few inches long?
Warblers are little bitty, some of the smallest in the bird world. Even smaller are the ruby-throated hummingbirds that are also migratory. And those guys are just tiny. And, you know, they weigh less than a French fry. And so...
Well, how far do they migrate?
Well, the ruby-throated hummingbird is a trans-Gulf migrant. And that means that it flies over the Gulf of Mexico. And again, a pretty definitive statement. It's not always the case. Some hug the coast. But a lot of them fly over the water. That's pretty amazing to think about, because that flight for a bird out over the Gulf of Mexico, let's say heading out over New Orleans or Galveston, heading out over the open ocean, that's a 17-hour nonstop flight for that bird. And out over the water, 17 hours, it's out over the water, it's fly or die. So it's just an extraordinary feat. And to think about what they're doing it on, which, you know, for a hummingbird is basically sugar water. That's what they're fueling this flight on.
Well, most of us have either have hummingbird feeders, or we know someone who has a hummingbird feeder, and we see the hummingbirds fighting over the sugar water, but I sure don't see how they can eat, you know, consume enough to go 17 hours without stopping.
It's an amazing feat, isn't it? And it's just, like I say, it's nonstop flight. So, and then they land over there in the Yucatan, kind of the landing pad, and or the launch pad for the reverse migration, when they're taking off from the Yucatan, flying northward over the Gulf. To do this twice a year, it just is something extraordinary to think about. Bird migration itself is really mind-blowing on a number of levels. And to me, it's one of the most compelling, most dramatic, most extraordinary phenomenons in all of natural history.
What kind of numbers? How many birds migrate?
Billions. Billions and billions of birds migrate. An estimated 2 billion migrate over our region.
And by our region, you're talking about Texas, Louisiana
right
Arkansas,
there along the border. That's right. Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas, right along the borderline of those states where they come together. An estimated 2 billion birds a year, which is pretty amazing. We're in the Central Flyway. And so that might sound a little odd, but there are these kind of highways or routes through the sky that birds take. And there are four across North America. And in our region, we're in the Central Flyway. And as you go a little further east towards New Orleans, you're in the Mississippi Flyway. And birds use land-based geographical sort
features.
Features to guide them on that flight. So the river systems, the Sabine, the Red River, the Mississippi, birds are using those features to help guide, we think, to help guide their migration. They're also using celestial light, the moon, the stars. So they're going up and down through North America, if it's maybe difficult to imagine, but through these kind of invisible super highways of bird migration.
Thousands of feet in the air.
Thousands of feet up in the air, exactly.
Why do they do it at night? Why do they migrate at night?
Right. Most birds are nocturnal migrants. Most birds migrate at night. And the thought is that it's cooler at night, so there's not as much heat and it doesn't wear them out as significantly. And also there are fewer predators at night. So predators like hawks, owls, many hawks are also migratory. And you'll see huge hawk migrations through the fall usually. But yeah, so there are fewer predators that are out and about to harm them. So they fly at night, and the vast majority of migratory birds are nocturnal migrants.
Well, tell us about the Lights Out for Wildlife initiative, and what are you asking people to do?
You bet. Well, back to light and light pollution, I guess I'll just say broadly, it's got this negative impact on a number of animals. So light disrupts natural cycles. It's artificial light. And so, you know, basically our bodies really aren't made to live with it on a regular and long-term basis. So it disrupts melatonin levels that are natural through the sleep cycles. It disrupts circadian rhythms, which are really important to the body. And I'm talking not just wildlife, but also humans. And even plant life, it's crazy. The photosynthetic cycle is made to be there to be a dark period and a light period. And when there's artificial light at night, that's completely disruptive of the photosynthetic cycle for plant life. So, and the studies are showing, I guess I would just kind of a human health note here, that to try to sleep in a bright, when there is bright light around, can really be destructive and can be linked to some pretty significant diseases. So just a note to, keep an eye on that, maybe to dig in and do a little more research about it. But we were made to sleep in a dark environment, and same thing with wildlife. So it disrupts reproductive cycles in amphibians, like many different types of frogs, which are which basically need the night celestial sky, the moon, the stars, and all of that, and a dark environment to help contribute to their reproductive cycles, their natural reproductive cycles. And then also insect life, again, back to the porch light and the big lights you see out, you know, in the car lots and all of that, and the insects swarming around it. Maybe it's a surprise, but that's not natural. That's very disruptive of all of that wildlife's natural rhythms where they're feeding. It disrupts feeding cycles, reproductive cycles, on and on and on. So it is something we got to pay attention to. Now back to bird life. We need to take action to basically create the darkest, safest sky possible for these migratory birds, because as I alluded to earlier, light is attractive to birds, so much so that they'll come down out of their very high migratory elevations when they're flying at night and will fly in an almost mesmerized way down towards bright light. If you just Google up, you'll see examples of that this issue's been an issue basically since artificial light was created and became widespread. So there are examples years ago, many years ago, of large bird collision events into the lit torch of the Statue of Liberty. More recently, there are examples of birds being trapped, just circling for hours and hours and hours, almost to exhaustion. In the 9/11 memorial, the two large beams of light that are shot up in New York City is a tribute to 9/11. And so hence, bird conservationists have have come forward, and now they pulse those lights. So the birds are just swirling within those beams of light. And then now the light is pulsed. And when it is, when it's darkened, the birds disperse. It's really extraordinary. And then the lights come back on. So that's a wonderful conservation action to help protect those birds there. And then they just, bird collisions are like the number three behind habitat loss and behind feral cats. Predation by feral cats, collision with buildings is the third highest cause of bird mortality.
Is this particularly a problem with tall buildings or more than other buildings?
Yeah, yeah. Well, the number one predictor of the number of collisions with a building is the amount of light it predicts, much more so than its height, which can be surprising to people. So they think about a skyscraper. And height is not the key predictor. It's the amount of light the building emits, which is what we need to all keep in mind. Those of us that are homeowners or have small buildings, small businesses, or parts of educational campuses, let's say college campuses or places of worship, et cetera. Even the small to mid-sized buildings can be pretty injurious to bird life if a lot of light is emitted. So, in fact, the studies show an equal number of birds are killed in residential and areas where the buildings are at medium or low height compared to the big downtown skyscraper areas in North America. And that is a staggering, so about equal amounts of injury in both areas. And it's basically estimated at up to a billion birds. Pretty extraordinary and hard to believe.
A billion birds lost just to collisions?
A billion birds lost to collision in the United States every year.
That could add up in a hurry.
Yeah. A lot of our bird populations are in steep decline, and we always, a lot of us in the conservation world will always say it's the loss of habitat. You know, you can imagine all the prairie that's been converted to agricultural land, all the cities that have been built and everything. That's, you know, that's basically bird habitat that's been being converted over all these years. And so we point to that. But I think when we know that we lose up to a billion birds a year to collision that light pollution contributes to every year in the United States alone, I think we have to take it very seriously as one of the key drivers to the decrease, the dramatic, almost crisis level decreases in our United States bird population.
Which brings us to the lights out for wildlife and what's the solution, Ben?
You bet. Well, in conservation, we often are taking hard choices, aren't we? We're often weighing out, like, you know, we do this and, you know, and it causes a lot of good in a lot of ways. And then we got to hold back, you know, because we want to also provide for the wildlife in our area, et cetera. It's hard choices over and over again, hard choices in conservation. But in this case, oh gosh, I just racked my brain trying to figure out, you know, some sort of a detriment or some sort of something that would be negative about this action, because it's very simple. And that is that during the peak months of migration, we try to eliminate or minimize as much light as possible through the hours of 11 p.m. to 6 a.m. That's what we're asking for. That's the call to action right there. Just the darkest sky possible from 11 p.m. to 6 a.m.
In short, turn the switch and turn off your light. Is that what you're telling us?
In short, flip a switch. It's a no-brainer.
Well, from what I've read, I gather that this is something that people are coming to understand, and we're even having whole cities adopt light ordinances. We're having big, tall skyscrapers say, we're going to turn off our lights during that period. From 11 to 6 during those weeks in the fall and spring, and on a grand scale. I know that, you know, we're sitting here in Shreveport, Louisiana, and I haven't investigated Shreveport, but I know about Dallas and Houston as being among the, you know, the really top cities for this being a problem. Tell us a little bit about what we've been able to convince people to do. I mean, who's turning off their lights?
You bet.
Well, you bring up a great point. There was a recent study that showed that out of the 125 most populous cities in North America, the worst for exposing the most number of birds to the most amount of light pollution, so that's a little bit of a tricky one there, but the city that exposes the most number of migratory birds to the most amount of light pollution was Chicago, followed secondly by Houston, and followed third by Dallas. And that really equates to, of course, the size of those cities, but also their place in the central flyway. So their geographic location within, they anchor basically Dallas and Houston, the central flyway, and Chicago's at the top there. These cities are taking really great action. A number of smaller cities as well, and cities throughout Louisiana also taking action on this front. So there are these mayoral proclamations, and lots of business leaders are taking action. It makes sense on so many fronts. It's a lot of energy savings, especially for those hours, 11 p.m. to 6 a.m., when exterior lighting can be turned off, when you can save a lot of money, when you can prevent a lot of carbon emission, you know, just down the line, it's the right thing to do. It helps out on the economic bottom line as well, and it saves scores of migratory birds. So we are seeing exciting progress, and a big collaboration has come together to promote the campaign, including former First Lady Laura Bush and her organization, Texan by Nature. The Cornell Lab has been really amazing with scientific expertise.
But by the Cornell Lab, you mean the Cornell University Ornithology Lab.
That's right.
The bird lab that's so famous among bird lovers.
That's right. The Cornell Lab of Ornithology, the storied and famous. They're really great. Texas A&M has also been very helpful. They're the repository for all the bodies that we find on our surveys through downtown, and on and on and on. Texas Parks and Wildlife and other fish and game commissions, and we've got a lot of great supporters, and so we're excited about it. Audubon as well.
So let's just recap a minute in case somebody's joined us since we started. We're talking with Ben Jones of Texas Conservation Alliance, who is one of the co-leaders in around the country in a new program called Lights Out for Wildlife to encourage cities, businesses, individuals, everyone who is concentrated on this to turn their lights off from 11 p.m. to 6 a.m. during the fall and spring weeks when billions of birds are migrating up the Central and Mississippi flyways, starting at the Gulf of Mexico, working their way all the way to Canada. And this is a big, wide flyway. It's multi-state wide. It's not just these states. And the purpose is to prevent bird collisions. And we're talking 1 billion bird collisions a year estimate.
That's right. It's a serious problem. Third highest cause of bird mortality behind habitat loss and feral cats. It's something that we can easily take action on. You know, one, I guess I should admit, sometimes when we say, let's go lights out for wildlife here, sometimes a false dichotomy can arise in people's minds where they think, isn't that unsafe? You know, light is an element that we think about when we think of safety. So sometimes some tension arises between those two things, but I want to make sure everybody knows that we're asking for all non-essential lighting to be off or dimmed during that period. And so everyone, business owners, homeowners, everybody makes the decision for themselves about what's essential lighting and what's not essential lighting. So we do want to make sure everybody understands that we just want non-essential lighting off during those periods. A lot of studies, interestingly, are showing that the only real safety benefit from lighting at night has to be basically connected to a surprise, or, and in this case, motion detection. So, you know, sometimes maybe you've experienced, like I have, you walk up to a friend's house at night and all of a sudden, boom, the lights come on outside the garage and you feel like you're being spotlighted. That, in fact, is the most safe approach when it comes to using light at night for safety purposes, much more so than a fixed light that's on all the time. You get much more of a safety benefit when you go to motion detectors. Also, you save a lot more energy, and also you help a lot more wildlife.
Well, we talk about the safety factor and reducing light. Obviously, any light that can be turned off, that's great. But when you do have a situation where you need lighting, aren't there things that can be done with how the lights are lights are aimed, excuse me, or what color the light is, that kind of thing?
Great. Yes, that's a great point. Absolutely. So this action and going lights out for wildlife can be as easy as, say, the lights need to stay on in the home or in a room or something like that. Drawing blinds, closing blinds, or drawing curtains. That can also, the whole idea is to prevent the most amount of light being emanated from the home as possible. So we think about blinds, we close them. We think about curtains, we close those. We think about porch lighting and make sure that there's a shield on the top that's allowing the light to just kind of point down in the region that it's needed. A lot of dark sky cities are going to these sorts of things. They can change bulbs from these really bright mercury bulbs to a little bit, anything that's a little less off that bright blue scale is really helpful, because that's been shown to be particularly harmful to birds and attracting to birds, of those that bright, bright blue light. So those are the things we can do. And we can just, you know, basically unplug or turn off landscape lighting that's just meant to be decorative during those months of peak migration. Again, in our region, really September, October, April, May. That's what we just got to think about, those 4 months a year. And so that's what we're doing, asking for simple lights out action to help save wildlife.
Are any of the birds that do this migration through the Central Flyway endangered species or rare or species we think are declining or have a problem?
Yes. Yes. A number of the prairie bird species are in really dramatic decline. Just a quick note, you know, it has to do with habitat. And early in the show, you asked about, well, let's think about habitat in a different way. The night sky is wildlife habitat. It's not the habitat we think about when we think of prairie and grasslands and wetlands and forests and all the things, the jungles of the world, where we think about that animals need to live. But when migratory birds are flying hundreds or thousands of miles twice a year through the night sky, it's really pretty basic when you think about it that way. This night sky is wildlife habitat. And as you referenced, some birds that are endangered or threatened or in decline are definitely part of these huge migrations. And I'd say prairie birds, for example, white-throated sparrow, which has this beautiful call. And to a lot of us, it's kind of the call. For the northerners, it's the call of spring. And for those of us in the south, it's kind of the call that we hear through winter. Really a classic whistle. They are particularly impacted by light pollution. And we've seen it in the literature and we've read about it. And it wasn't until we started doing some surveys ourselves that we actually saw the on the ground issue. And so white-throated sparrows are pretty dramatically impacted. Grasshopper sparrows also. We've seen a number of woodcocks, which are two, you know, which are game bird species in some areas. And we've seen a lot of woodcock collisions. Also the rails, which you think about in marsh habitat and beautiful Virginia rails and clapper rails and sora rails, also impacted by light pollution.
Well, most of us, when we think of sparrows, we kind of think about the sparrows in the parking lot at the McDonald's trying to steal our French fries. But there are really a lot of kinds of sparrows, and a lot of the sparrows we see in a parking lot are not native birds. They've been introduced from other parts of the world, but there are a lot of lovely native sparrows, and I'm particularly fond of the white-throated sparrow. I used to hear them in my yard in the wintertime, and sorry to hear that they're having such a hard time.
Yeah, the most number of any one species that we found during surveying for collisions was white-throated sparrow.
Well, tell us about the surveying process. What do you do to survey for birds?
Right. So a number of cities are doing this. Volunteers are gathering from conservation organizations like Texas Conservation Alliance or TCA, from Audubon centers and chapters, and master naturalists are gathering. And they are going out into areas where we have a hunch that there could be collision issues. So brightly lit regions. And we survey early morning. So during the months of peak migration, in our case, we survey for 50 mornings every fall and for 50 mornings every spring. and we just walk a certain route that we've defined. We have 10 buildings that we examine closely, and then everything in between them as well. It's a 7-mile route for us. And a lot of times there's enough volunteers where we get to divide it.
Now, wait a minute. Y'all walk 7 miles every morning?
Every morning at 6 a.m. It's a great way to start the day. Dead birds and 7 miles snow. But,
and still dark.
Right? And still dark a lot of times of the year. But we have enough people where we divide. And some people start, you know, at building number 10 while others start at building number 1. And we meet in the center. So we cut it, you know, to 3.5 miles, which is much more reasonable. But sometimes we have to do all 7 if it's a small crew. But we're just looking for bird collisions there along the buildings and along the sidewalks.
And you actually collect the dead birds?
And we log them. We do. We collect them, we photograph them, we identify them, we measure them, and we collect the bird's body. We put it in a Ziploc baggie and roll it up and put it in a backpack and take a photo of it and log it into iNaturalist. So those folks who are interested in nature, they're listening.
Tell us what iNaturalist is.
It's a giant database of observations by naturalists around the world. And it's a way for you to take a photograph of something, upload it, and then you'll have people review. And they'll actually say you're having trouble identifying the animal. You just upload it, and then you'll get some people comment. Reviewers will comment and kind of let you know, oh, you know what? That actually looks like, you know, a grasshopper sparrow or an orchard oriole or an American red start. You know, they'll help you out with IDs. And it's not just birds. It's just things across the spectrum.
But bird watching is a big deal, and wildlife watching is a big deal from an economic point of view.
These are
big recreational industries. Do you have any?
Billions of dollars go into bird watching alone every year, and so it really is huge economic impact. You know, Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas, they're incredible states for nature and outdoor resources and outdoor activity and recreation. And so it is something from an economic standpoint to keep a very close eye on.
So the decline in bird species would have with it a decline in recreation, which would have a decline in economic, the economy of a region.
It could, potentially. And I think when we think about our region here is a globally important bird destination globally, and it surprises some people to know that people fly in from around the world during migration, especially spring migration, to along the coastlines of our states to watch those birds fly basically over the Gulf of Mexico, and then from exhaustion land down on the coast to rest, refuel, to feed, to get water. And it's an extraordinary event. Some of the listeners may have been there and actually seen it firsthand, but people travel from around the world to come to our area for bird life. There are 10,000-ish bird species in the world. In North America, there are about 1,000. We have about a tenth of the world's bird species. I'm rounding up here. And then kind of in our region, out of that 1,000, we've got close to 700-ish. So that's pretty amazing if you think about it in that way. 700 of North America's 1,000 bird species basically are in our region. So pretty incredible.
That is a rather startling statistic.
Yeah.
Well, after you do your bird surveys and you collect the specimens, what do you do with them?
Good question, right. So we've got these backpacks with birds in Ziploc baggies and little tags to remind us where we found them and all of that. All of it's loaded up into the database, iNaturalist. We've got a special project there. And then we, in our case, we take them to a museum in Dallas, the Perot Museum of Nature and Science, and they house them in a freezer there until the end of the season. And then at the end of the season, we courier them to, and it's all, it's important that you bring this up because actually all this is under specific permits. Texas Parks and Wildlife in our case, and also U.S. Fish and Wildlife, we have salvage and special permits to be able to do this. All native bird life in North America is protected by federal law. That surprises a lot of people too. But so even handling birds or feathers or nests or eggs of native species is actually technically surprising to a lot of people illegal. So to have these bird bodies, we have to be under special permit. And we all the partners in the campaign have those special permits. So we get them to the Perot Museum and they house them, and then we transport them to Texas A&M where they're kept in a repository there, and they're able to be used for scientific studies there. Everything from isotope studies to parasite studies to ornithologists are able to reference that data set.
Now, wait a minute. What's an isotope study?
Well, we're getting into, you know, kind of a deeper level science here, but that's where they can take nail clippings from the bird or bits of the feather and be able to tell where the bird came, where it was raised, where it was born and raised, and they can tell what part of the country through different isotope studies
where that bird came from. So they could wind up telling how far they flew,
right.
What their patterns were, where they came from.
That's right.
This is... Quite a remarkable amount of research and quite a remarkable size database to store all this information.
It's really important to science, and we, as those of us collecting the animals, you can imagine it's pretty sobering to witness migration in this way. When you see the different waves of species come through, and you're finding those that were impacted by collision events hitting buildings, basically. That it's pretty sobering, right? But there's this idea that their body can be used for scientific study is a little bit of a silver lining, I guess.
Well, let's talk about what our listeners can do.
Great question. So, right, as we mentioned, the program's called Lights Out for Wildlife, and we're just trying to encourage as many folks to dim or darken their lighting around their homes or the areas that they have jurisdiction over, their businesses, their campuses, their schools, their places of worship, etc., to dim or darken as much light as possible during the peak months of bird migration. And again, it's September and October in our region, and then in the spring, it's April and May. So that's what we're asking for, from 11 p.m. till 6 a.m. to darken as much as possible and to advocate for it with municipal leaders and with elected leaders and things like that. We can all take action. The Dark Sky Association has a lot of information on this and examples of cities that are taking action on this front. So that's really inspirational, and it's something we can all do.
So are you saying that whole cities have said, we're going to make it our policy that we're going to encourage people to turn off their lights from 11 p.m. to 6 a.m. during the fall and spring migration? Well, are cities following through with turning off the lights at, you know, the landscaping at the city hall, mm-hmm. The parks, the things that the city itself has charge over?
We've seen it. You know, it's we've seen it right there with our own eyes, is that, yes, city buildings have gone dark, which is really great during those during the call to action from 11 p.m. to 6 a.m. So absolutely they are. And some cities are dedicated to dark skies, and those are usually where there's an astronomical kind of
like an observatory
facility. Say an observatory out in, I'm thinking of West Texas, the McDonald Observatory, and all the communities around there where light pollution seriously impacts the amount of, you know, the celestial sky that the telescopes are able to see, and it can impact the research there. And also back to the economic factor, also many people go out there for stargazing and those sorts of things. So right, big community-wide ordinances and guidance along those lines are helping keep that night sky as dark as possible, which is really a wonderful thing. And we're seeing it around the globe now. I've been reading some newspaper articles and of that happening in bits and pieces around the world in different cities. And it's really exciting. And one thing I guess we haven't talked about now, it's kind of hard to, it's hard to articulate or quantify, because it's more of sort of an aesthetic thing, almost maybe even a spiritual thing in some ways. And that's this idea that, do we kind of have a right to see into the universe each day in our community? And what does that do to a person and their mind and to children? Is it important for us as a community to for people to be able to see stars and see the heavens and at night together, you know, out on a picnic blanket, looking up into the sky. Is that important to us as, you know, as city dwellers? And a lot of people are beginning to say yes and ask the questions about what psychologically does it do when we lose that, which we all enjoyed, many of us as kids and as part of our childhood. It's mysterious and magical and really powerful. And to lose that because of light pollution is also something for us to all consider.
We're talking with Ben Jones of Texas Conservation Alliance and one of the co-leaders in the Lights Out for Wildlife initiative. Ben, I think there's some kind of program for certifying or people can sign up and say, I'm going to do this. I'm going to turn off my lights during the fall and spring migration.
A lot of folks might be familiar with Gardening for Wildlife, which is run by National Wildlife Federation. And that's a way for you to certify your yard if it provides the elements of wildlife habitat. And that is in this case, water, food, space to raise their young, shelter of some kind. So you go online and you check those things off and you're able to certify your yard as wildlife habitat. Well, we decided that because this light pollution issue is so also critical to wildlife, that we wanted to offer a similar certification. So it's called Lights Out for Wildlife. You can go to tcatexas.org, tcatexas spelled out, .org, and click on Lights Out. And then you just let us know what kind of actions you're taking with your family there around your home or your farm place, et cetera. And are you closing the blinds during those hours? Are you switching off that outdoor lighting? Are you making sure the curtains are closed when you've got indoor lighting on? And you just click, click, click with these radio buttons on the website and just give us your name. And we don't even ask for address or anything, just the city you're in and your email address. And when you submit that, we then review it. And then we, when we see that you've taken the actions that are needed to go Lights Out for Wildlife, we email you a certificate, a personalized certificate, thanking you for your commitment to conservation, giving you something to celebrate it, that commitment to conservation with, and to share with your friends and family and to encourage them to take action as well. So it's pretty simple. Lights Out for Wildlife, and of course it's free. We'd love for as many people to take action on that front as possible. Join with us.
And that's on the Texas Conservation Alliance website?
That's right, tcatexas.org. Just once you get on there, click on Lights Out and certify your home, business, building as Lights Out for Wildlife and be proud of that action stepping forward to help save these birds.
Well, that's pretty cool. I'm guessing that TCA and tcatexas.org is Texas Conservation Alliance.
You're guessing right. That's it.
Well, actually, I kind of knew the answer. You've mentioned several organizations that are involved in this, but it's bigger than just Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas, even bigger than the Central Flyway and the Mississippi Flyway.
Right.
You mentioned there are international efforts, because I guess the old world has flyways too, doesn't it?
They sure do. The National Geographic puts out a map of the flyways of the world. It's really incredible to take a look at. Birds obviously around the world. Not all are migratory, as we mentioned earlier in the discussion. A number of species are resident. You know, in our case, I'll just mention a couple of resident birds. So bird species like cardinals, you're going to see them year-round, winter and summer. What are some other species?
Mockingbirds.
Mockingbirds year-round. You're going to see mockingbirds. Owls are basically residential. The barred owls, the great horned owls, the screech owls, all stay put. But all those other birds that do migrate, even like the whooping crane, an amazing endangered species that has a 3,000-mile migration from far north Canada all the way down to Aransas, the coastline of Texas, is extraordinary. So this amazing wild migratory bird. So around the world, birds are migrating, you know, migration is about following food. And so they're doing that, and absolutely cities are taking action from all over Europe to parts of Africa and Asia. are beginning to realize that this is an issue and are beginning to try to, for a host of great reasons, minimize light pollution in their regions, for, from everything from human health to, again, the importance of viewing and gazing into the night sky to helping restore wildlife habitat in their region and help protect it from the impacts of light pollution. So, right, and then in the United States, or I guess you should say our hemisphere, Toronto's a real leader with a program called FLAP, Fatal Light Awareness Program, FLAP for short. They're a real leader in this work. Also, New York City and Chicago and another of other cities and down here in our regions really taking off as well. So, exactly. It's great to know that a lot of people are taking action on this front. It's burgeoning. It's just now becoming part of a lot of people's awareness. And so it's great to hop on right now and get going.
Well, anybody who's seen satellite photographs of North America at night, it's just stunning how much of the whole continent is lighted up, particularly in the eastern seaboard and so forth. And when you think about the price tag of all that light, this is something we can do that's such a win-win because it's good for wildlife, but it's also would have some tremendous economic benefits along with it, a lot of cost saving.
That's exactly right.
And energy saving.
That's right. And emissions saving. And so on all those fronts, it's really an important thing to do. And also, many of us are motivated by this idea of zero waste, that we want to function and operate in a way that produces as little waste, that we waste as little as possible in our businesses and our personal lives and everything. So on that front as well, currently from those satellite views, it's kind of a symbol of pretty significant waste. And so to address that, it's also a really important thing to do and really exciting that people are taking action on that front.
Again, we're visiting with Ben Jones, the Executive Director of Texas Conservation Alliance, about Lights Out for Wildlife. And what we're hearing is that all of us can take actions in our homes and by encouraging our city governments and other elected officials to get behind this initiative that's good for wildlife, good for birds, migrating birds in particular, but also good for people. We've heard a lot about the decline of birds. I mean, this is apparently a really serious problem that's going on, and it is linked in part to habitat. What else do you mean by habitat besides this light pollution and the airway habitat that we're talking about today?
Right. Well, habitat is basically land, food, space, and shelter. And so all of us need it, all wildlife need it, and all humans need it. Think about your own life. And so the loss of habitat basically means the loss of a home for wildlife, and that is the key driver of wildlife loss or extinction and threats in the United States today and for the most part around the world. So it's important that we address habitat in a whole host of ways, everything from prairie, which is our most endangered ecosystem now. We used to have hundreds of millions of prairies stretching across North America, and now less than 1% remains. So prairie is a type of habitat, and forest is a type, and wetlands is a type, and on and on and on. You can imagine even the Arctic tundra, et cetera, and jungles and all of that. So we just have to think about it. And here, just again, you know, that the night sky is a critical and important part of habitat for migratory birds. And we are, as some scientists describe, in this sixth mass extinction, we're losing wildlife at about 1,000 times the natural rate. It's heavy. It's hard to think about. It's not fun. But it's reality. And I think we have to realize that and then take action where we can. And which brings us back to Lights Out for Wildlife, which is simple action, a no-brainer action, simple action that we can all take to save scores of migratory birds, these extraordinary animals that bring so much joy, if you're like me, to your life, where you can watch with your family and friends and their songs in our parks and around our houses and their feeding outside our windows. And They're just beautiful. Birds are some of the most beautiful and extraordinary things in nature. They make the best sounds. They're so incredibly beautiful. We get to see them in their families. They're the most accessible, I think, of all the wildlife. We see them every day.
And they're what I hear when I take my walk in the morning, which I'm doing for exercise, but then it turns out to be this experience, and I wonder what bird I'm
that's right.
hearing.
Yeah. That's right. And as we kind of close up here, you know, they're doing these extraordinary things. You're laying in bed. It's a nocturnal phenomenon. It's why a lot of people aren't aware of it, but we're laying in bed there during migration, and it is a super highway of migratory birds above us as we sleep. It's kind of fascinating to think about.
I just can't imagine it.
Hundreds of millions of birds are soaring over us as we're laying there cozy and covered up in our bed at night on a super highway of migration. And they're flying for sometimes thousands and thousands of miles. They're performing extraordinary feats. And I think when we think about Lights Out for Wildlife and what we can do to help, you know, that kind of thing just motivates me, just knowing what they overcome and do every year, twice a year in the case of migration, makes me want to be in their corner.
Well, we love to see stories of people overcoming obstacles, yeah. climbing mountains, yeah. running races,
right.
and we don't think about the fact that little tiny birds, little tiny hummingbirds and slightly larger birds are... Yeah, they're doing the same thing.
Incredible feats, incredible feats. We're surrounded by incredible feats of nature.
Yes. Well, I want so very much to thank you, Ben, for coming and talking about this exciting initiative. I'm personally excited to see how much attention it's getting. And from national leaders, state leaders, and you know, cities that are taking the lead on doing this. But it's particularly exciting because it's something that we each of us can do.
That's right.
All we have to do is kind of go stand out in the yard and look at our house and say, okay, what's a bird's eye view of my house, and what do I need to do to make a difference here? And then we'll, you know, make it. We can make a
Absolutely.
Difference.
Absolutely. Let's go Lights Out for Wildlife.
I haven't certified my house yet, but I think I better go home and do that. Thank you all for joining us on Conserving Earth, a series that we hope is going to be a lot of fun. We hope you're going to be joining with us regularly. There'll be other hosts on other occasions, and I'll be back in a couple of months, and really would like to have all of you join us.